Hello and welcome, everybody, to week three. This is our live session at Ryzo 14. These are being done with the MIT Media Lab's Unhangout, put together by Philip and the fine folks over there at the lab. And they've been kind enough to allow us to use it. So this software, this sort of thing, allows us to have one sort of live video presentation, and that's what I'm doing right now, and then a bunch of breakout sessions, and that allows you to go into the breakout sessions and get into a groups and have a normal hangout conversation. Some things I should say about that. This particular part of the recording is actually something that we have as an archive. The other hangouts, the breakout rooms, do not get recorded. So if we're going to have any kind of record of this conversation, it's going to have to come into this conversation, this central conversation. That has not worked out ideally so far, because what ends up happening is that we have a conversation in the middle, we go out to breakout rooms, this goes to dead air, and then we end up with some kind of feedback mechanism at the end. So this time what we're going to do is we're going to switch that around a little bit, and I'm going to have this conversation here. I'm going to do a 10-minute intro, and then maybe we're going to bring some people in who have some ideas. We're going to do the breakouts at the end, and then a quick run back to the chat room at the very, very end of the discussion. So we're going to try that out as a format, see if that works out a little bit. Topic this week, of course, is uncertainty, and, well, probably fitting, embracing uncertainty. I think that this is, it seems to be resonating with a lot of people out there. I mean, I certainly don't claim to have made up any of the ideas. These are things that I've been stealing from my friends, and they've stolen from their friends, and has passed along for a long time. But I think we had a really interesting conversation last night on teachers teaching teachers on EdTech Talk, for those of you who are not familiar, edtechtalk.com. And somebody said, oh, you know what, that feeling of uncertainty is something that I've always had in my teaching, and I've always kind of felt like I should hide it. Like somehow the fact that I didn't know the answer or I didn't know how a particular session was going to go made me feel like I wasn't doing my job properly. And I think, to some degree, for a lot of people, the whole Rizomatic learning thinking approach is as much about permission to do the stuff that they know they want to do anyway. When I call Rizomatic learning, when I call it a story, what I mean by that is that stories are things that allow us to come to understand the ways that we are as people, to share how we are, share our feelings about the context we live in, the things that we know. And in some ways, it gives us the language that we need to be able to do that sharing. And I think that, for me, in my experience at least, the people for whom Rizomatic learning seems automatic, it's been people who have had this idea of uncertainty at the middle of what they do. I read a blog post earlier today from somebody who was saying that as a child, they always thought that parents had it all together, that adults knew what was going on, that there was some kind of secret that they didn't have access to. And that one of the things about growing up is you realize that those secrets don't actually exist. There's no sort of pantheon of knowledge out there that you somehow acquire through adulthood to make you certain of the decisions you're making or make you realize that there are correct ways of going about doing things. Rather, you start to realize that the uncertainty is part of your life. And not just as humans in our bodily form, but uncertainty in terms of the knowledge we have and the ways we make decisions. And I think that that's a realization that many of us do make, and the idea that some of us are able to bring that to our classrooms. And that's the real question for me from a pedagogical standpoint, is how do we make that uncertainty a part of what we do as teachers, a part of what we do as learners, a part of what we do as participants in a community, so that A, we're demystifying what we're doing in the sense that we're telling people that not knowing is something we all share, that we each of us have stories that help us know a little bit better and we can share those stories, but it's not like those definitions that we have for words have real meaning. You know, there are nuances and subtleties that we don't necessarily share all the time but are still a really deep part of what it means to know. So if you know something about how to teach, for instance, and many of us are educators, the knowing how to teach has a deep uncertainty to it. You know, you can try one thing with a class one time and try to do exactly the same thing the next time and see how it doesn't turn out the same. It's not a cookie cutter process that replicates itself. There's a feeling to it and in a way in which you can approach it that is sometimes better and sometimes not, and that seems to be different every time, and it's a weird one, right? And I think that as we make that part of what we do, we make the learning process more authentic. And I mean, I think authenticity is really important. Because I think it allows us to transition from the learning environment, so-called, from the learning process. And again, I know Francis will say we're concentrating too much on formal education, but from that organized learning thing back to the world an awful lot easier, and hopefully at some point make that thing, that transition almost transparent, so that the learning process is actually the world process, and we break down those barriers in between. And I would say course, because the uncertainty needs some structure in order for us to be able to talk about it. And to me, that's what the course part of all this, and in that same conversation with teachers teaching teachers last night, Christina Cottrell, who is from the National Writing Project, said that what they had talked about was a massive open online collaboration. And I think there's something powerful about that as well, as long as what we're doing is applying enough structure to a conversation that new people can join. And I think we've been partially successful with that here in RISO 14. I think that certainly people have tried really, really hard to have people be able to participate and have people be able to join in. I think we've been marginally successful. I think we've been more successful with some things than with others, but that's inevitable. I think in some cases, the people who were trying to join didn't necessarily have the collaborative literacies that they needed to be able to do that as well as they might. And I think in some cases, there are things that could have structured better to allow for that, to have enough structure to be able to have new people come in and face that uncertainty with the rest of us. So I guess for me, that is the uncertainty claim is at the core of rhizomatic learning, and it's at the core of the things that we need to do from a practical perspective to give people room to be responsible, to bring people into the community of knowing, to allow them access. So, you know, when you say things are true and you don't know them, you're not giving access, you're making an impermeable membrane between the knowers and the not-knowers, or rather, maybe even a permeable membrane that I'm supposed to carve through, and somehow when I get to the other side of that membrane, I will be a knower and transition from not knowing to knowing, which is just not the way that I think learning happens, and I don't think, certainly the blog posts I read this week, most of you don't share that feeling either. So I guess the questions that I have, and I will, it's hard in this medium because I'm going to ask a question, there's going to be a 30-second pause, so I'm going to try to allow for that in the way that I do this. So my question then is, given the stuff that you guys have read this week, are there particular things that you guys would like to structure a talk about, like with a breakout room where we could set up, or is there somebody who would like to, let's do it this way, is there somebody who would like to come into the conversation? So if you drop your email address in the chat room, I will invite you into this conversation, and you can make the point that you feel about the topic this week, or like so many people, diverge where you like, and we'll try to turn it into a conversation as well. So I'd really like to have more people in the main conversation today. So if you guys could drop that email address, I think I can add via email address here, your Gmail account, the same one that you're using to get in here right now, and I will add you in to the conversation, and you can tell me what it is that you think about this and what your response is to this stuff. I think while I'm waiting, I'll address what Brooke had said about improv. I think there's some of that there. I think that there's something really important about having that sort of uncertainty and that ability to react, that's so much a part of what the improv is about. And I think also the muscle that you need to exercise to be able to do improv. For those of you who have ever done it, I've done a little bit of sort of one of those 3-4 hour dinner theater things where you have a character and you're constantly reacting to the crowd and stuff. And it can be really hard. And the first couple of times that you struggle and you think, well, how's this possible? But as you warm up those muscles up, as you develop them, as you develop your ability to respond to the environment, you get better and better at them. Look at that, Vanessa Vale. How exciting is that? I don't know if I've ever talked to Vanessa. So I'm going to try and invite her in. We'll see how this works. Feel free to have more people come in. There's no need to, there's room for 10. So I have no problem bringing a variety of people in. Like I say, I think we'll do that for a while, and then we'll break out to breakout sessions at the end so that we don't break up the video in the same way that we did last time, so it becomes more watchable after the fact. Oof. And doesn't improv's number one rule always say yes, engaging with the environment? Yeah, that sounds about right to me. So I'm posting these invitations to you guys. I haven't seen anybody accept them yet. I hope that that's working. I'm not convinced that a rhizome is concerned with certainty-uncertainty paradigm. It just does. Paige, again, I think that with the rhizome thing, the Elizabeth, the email addresses are being used to include people in the live discussion. So I'm inviting those people into the live discussion so that we can have a little bit more interaction here at the front end. So I'll give you a chance to rescind your offer. And if you post your email address again, I'll bring it in here. To go back to what Paige had said, the rhizome again here, we're talking about rhizome from the philosophical sense, not necessarily just the plant. And I wouldn't even argue from the plant's perspective that it goes where the environment allows it to go. And when you say it just goes, from a predictive standpoint, it's pretty tough to actually, I won't call it chaotic exactly, because I think the specific meaning there is tougher. But you're certainly not sure how it is going to work. I don't see anybody, actually. Oh, look at that. We've got 5 folks. Let's see here. It's a good question, Vanessa. I've never tried to invite quite this way before. So I'm going to see what it says here. So it says add people to this video call. And then when I click invite, it says invitation posted. So I think it is in your Google Plus stream. So I think you should be able to join this straight from the Google Plus link, now that I think about it. Let me see if I can do that too. Try joining from the Google Plus page. Let's try that. So I've sent out 5 invites, and I've sent out the link there. I will also, so that should, between those two things, we should be able to find a way to get people in here. Let's hope that that works. And while we're waiting for that to manifest itself, I will address the other, there's Mike Caulfield again. No, Tom, I think you make a really good point. Tom's point here in the chat room is, so it's not really an entirely uncertain goal, but it is a moving one. And yeah, I think that's maybe a better way of putting it. And the content of what the thing we're trying to acquire is not as certain as we'd like it to be. So it's both a claim about the process and also a claim about the goal. Did I hear a person?
Yes.
Hooray!
Yeah!
It worked. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi.
I don't know if we've ever spoken, have we?
No.
I've known you for years, but...
Hey, third time in a hangout.
Woohoo!
Ever.
There we go. We got people coming in. Excellent. There's Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Okay. So, well, Vanessa made it in first, so we'll give Vanessa the chance to try first. What do you think? Feedback, comments, feelings you'd like to share? Fruit you'd like to throw?
Well, I'm still navigating the technology.
Well, we hear you just fine, though. You go ahead. Do you have any sort of direct comment, any comments you'd like to come out with, Vanessa, in terms of what you think about things as they stand right now?
Well, this is what just... Let me turn off the sound on the other video.
Oh, right. So you've got the backup sound. I should say that to everybody before you come in, is that while you come into this, you should definitely pause the video on the other end because you will not be able to understand what's going on. While Vanessa's navigating okay. that, Sarah, why okay. don't you go ahead? Sarah? I'm having a hard time getting people to talk today. Funny, because I got two people who are certainly capable of riding all over the place. Oh, Sarah, you just muted. What do you think, Sarah?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, is my mic working?
You sound just fine. Look at you with your accent. I had no idea where you were from.
I'm from Scotland, but
there you go.
I'm actually from England.
Okay.
So, but I live up in Scotland because it's better.
Because it's better.
Yeah. Yes. Better government. Less state, okay. Much better.
There we go. So do you have feelings you'd like to share?
No.
What?
No, I do. I'm sort of thinking about post-structuralism generally and just wondering, I mean, do we think with uncertainty that all knowledge is up for grabs? Or is some knowledge grounded?
Wow. Somebody wrote a beautiful piece yesterday or the day before, I don't know when, it's a total blur for me at this point, where they said, we just have to remember with the rhizome to look at the trees that are in between them.
Kath Ellis.
With Kath Ellis, there you go. It was a great post, actually. And I think, at least from a practical standpoint, whether or not it deeply philosophical works itself out, there are some customs that are built inside of our ideas of knowledge that are so deeply ingrained that we might as well talk about them as if they're true, because inside of a given domain of knowledge, they're so automatic that to tear them apart and try to look at them from a position of uncertainty ends up being this sort of philosophical journey you're taking rather than a practical one to actually get somewhere useful. That's the way that I look at it. So, for instance, really simple examples, and in any of my classrooms, we end up using Twitter. Is it, does it make sense? Is it the right one? Is it the only? Can we all sort of rhizomatically wander our way towards a communication mechanism? We could, but it's not practical. So I take that sort of technology claim to be the same as any of the knowledge claims that I say as being automatic. So I might, in talking about, if I was going to teach a formal classroom in education, you can't skip behaviorism. You might not like it, but you really can't avoid talking about it at some level because it's such useful language to describe a large subsection of what we do culturally, what we do socially, what we do from a learning perspective. So you might as well talk about it as if it's a tree. You might as well call it real, regardless of what your deep down philosophical feelings are about it. So that's how I look at it. Does that resonate for you?
Yes, I guess so. Although I was swithered between thinking, well, there is actually not truth out there, but we can never get to it.
Right.
You know, the sort of the Kantian perspective. Yes.
And it may be true, but at the end of the day, the way that it transitions is that with every one of those is true, we end up confronted with the same issue. Right? And that's that when we get to the classroom and we're trying to teach something, we can take it from the standpoint that there is certain knowledge and you just haven't gotten there yet. Or the knowledge is vaguely uncertain, but these are the guideposts that are going to make conversation with other people who do know an awful lot easier to manage and maintain. And that's kind of the way that I look at it. Uh-oh. There's Doug. Hi, Doug. Hi, Keith. How you guys doing?
Very well, Dave. Hi.
Just from a technical standpoint, did you get the invitation or did you click on the link?
I got the invitation in Google Plus, and then I saw an email just after that.
Okay. Okay. So I've sent out a bunch of invitations. I do apologize if I've missed a few people, but I have done my best. So let's start. Let's keep going over in that direction. What about you, Keith? How are you doing? Well, I don't hear Keith yet. All right, we'll skip back. Vanessa, have you got all your technology stuff sorted out?
Pretty much, pretty much. I let myself out unintentionally and got right back in.
Good.
I don't mind uncertainty. I think I do better with uncertainty than I do with certainty.
Okay.
Although sometimes it's nice to take a break and get back to a little certainty when you don't need to catch your breath or something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think so. Go ahead.
Well, this is interesting comparing this with doing the more structured courses, too. I think a lot of us in here are in the Ed Future course as well. And I can tell there are people in it who aren't used to doing large courses or online, or they're used to online, but they're not used to MOOCs. I mean, to use that word that we're supposed to be avoiding using. And they think that it's just wildly experimental. And I'm going like, come on, throw us some uncertainty here. You know, say something that just throws everybody off and makes them go, what's he going on about?
I almost think you're referring to me now.
Well, actually, the christening did stick, didn't it?
Yes, well, what are you gonna do?
Well, it's been validated by the Cognog.
Oh yes, that's right.
That's true.
He's not to be trusted anyway.
Well, let's see if isn't there a one of those little sort of Greek paradox things, logic test things that sort of like the Greek tells you that all Greeks are liars. Is he telling the truth or lying?
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of like that, isn't it?
A little bit.
Yes. Yeah. But it's... Now, I don't know what I'm going to do with it.
Well...
What we're doing in here. I'm still not sure of that. But it's fun swimming around.
Sure. So, from your perspective, Keith, I don't know if you've got your volume going on. Can we hear you now?
I don't know. Can you?
You sound just fantastic.
Great.
What, you've been doing this stuff as long or longer than I have. Keith, how do you feel about how the course is going so far?
See, I'm not having a problem with the course. I'm very, very happy. The course does all the things that I've been expecting it to do all along, which is to engage me in good conversation with good people who want to understand this a little bit better and who are helping me push it forward. I will have to say that in contrast to those who are perhaps doing a MOOC for the first time or thinking about these issues for the first time, I have been thinking about it a while. So I do have some, I bring to the conversation some grounding points that perhaps they don't have,
right,
and some anchors that that I got that developed in other MOOCs 3-4 years ago, and that certainly helps. I do remember my disorientation in the first MOOC I attended, which I took me a while to figure it out and to realize what was happening. And then to figure out, well, how can I do this a little bit better next time? And I think there are ways to do it. Anchoring is a way that I like to do it. I pick something, anything, almost anything that you can pick in a MOOC will work for you. Even if you let it go and move on to something else quickly, or if you hang with that resource. I've been paying attention in this particular MOOC a little bit more to what's going on in the Google Plus stream, not so much in the Facebook. Means I lost a lot of things. But one of the things I learned to give up very quickly was trying to get it all. Not going to.
Yeah. I wonder, Keith, if
but
that...
But it doesn't matter. I've gotten enough.
I wonder if that binding that you're talking about, you know, when we look at one of the first criticisms that people have of the internet, of Twitter, of MOOCs, of abundant things generally, and I see certainly the potential of Rizomatic Learning totally bundled with abundance, if I can say that. I wonder if the shaping that normally happens in curriculum is about creating certainty through scarcity, so that we say, these are the things we're going to learn, and then as learners, we've gotten accustomed to not missing anything, getting all of the curriculum because we were supposed to get it all. And whether or not that's one of the sort of underlying constructs of the paper-based world that needs to be opened up for people to be able to learn and think rhizomatically. Does that resonate for you at all?
It does, and I'll tell you how it does. And for me, the rhizomatic approach is not the new or the exception. I think it's the print-based stuff that was the exception.
Uh-huh.
You know, when Aboriginal peoples were dumped out in the wilderness at some place, they had to make lots of rhizomatic decisions very, very early. They had to anchor themselves on some mountain or get some sort of a guide and then start moving about and finding out where they were and how they were going to get back to wherever it was that they wanted to go. And so I think this is learning in a more ancient style, which says this: we're in a very, very large world with no shortage of information. We sort of commoditized information with print, and we made it scarce. And now that's gone back to being ample and open. It also touches, for me, on the linear process, the local causality, that anything that happens is caused by something immediately prior to it and near mm-hmm. to it. And it overlooks the causality of the whole, which is the global causality, which pulls us to different forms and to, for instance, the being in this MOOC has made me think about things that I wouldn't have thought about otherwise. And it's pulled me to think about those things. It hasn't forced me to think about them.
Right.
And so I like that kind of pull from the larger group. And I find myself echoing patterns that I see there almost because that's what humans do. We echo patterns with each other.
Yeah.
And we pick up on this and we run with it, and if we like it, we develop it and it gets stronger. If we don't like it and it doesn't work for us, we move on and let it go, and it flows out. I don't know that I answered your question.
No, but again, you ended up taking it in a direction that I couldn't have predicted. So we're all good.
Yeah.
We're all good. Thanks. I'm gonna see if I can't get a couple other feedback. Doug, I'm going to do a terribly unfair thing to you. I'm going to ask you a question. My whole MOOC thing started in 2005 when I started working with EdTech Talk. I don't mean that I was doing a MOOC, but rather I joined this community and worked with this community of educators and started realizing that I was learning things and was prepared to do things without ever having taken a course or done anything else. I'd not done anything overtly. I was just part of this regular conversation that was happening. And because of that regular conversation, I seemed to be more able to do my job. And it sort of had me thinking about all this abundance of input and all this sort of but totally unstructured kinds of conversation that allowed me to learn. And that's where I came from in this. What do you think is the difference, Doug, between a community like EdTech Talk, which is going on still, it's almost 10 years old now, and a MOOC, which is 6 weeks long? What do you think the distinction is there from your perspective? And you've been doing this with me since the beginning.
Right. I think I'd echo some of Keith's sentiments in terms of having a skill set or a fluency with tools and behaviors that perhaps predisposes one to wait for that outcome. It may not be entirely evident, you may not until the very end. We know ourselves in terms of those regular tech talk, oftentimes it was the after show where the real magic plans, agenda, we talk about this topic for 20 minutes or half an hour, and then the show proper was over, where the real magic would happen. I think, ironically enough, very early on, that one meeting where the webhead showed up en masse, and I can't remember how many tens or even hundreds of people were trying to jam into that chat room, just to it was evident that a possibility from those number of people coming together. I guess the thing with EdTech Talk was it was a voyage of discovery that we all set about. Perhaps the difference here is that people expect something finite to happen within 6 weeks. Again, I think a lot of it comes down to your experience with these environments and how something I mentioned in a blog post this week was that whole notion of sort of giving up on certainty and letting it. And I think I've seen it happen enough times that I'm willing just to let it take us where we go. Fortunately enough, we don't have hand in or again, we're an informal or open environment where it can go where it wants to, and some of us are more comfortable with that than others.
Yeah, it's interesting. I find Keith's comment about paper being the anomaly, right? It's almost like a return to uncertainty rather than a development, taking an old literacy and sort of bringing it back into our culture, that willingness to be able to give in to the uncertainty of that conversation. Two people who just came in who I haven't known for a long time. Jolly, why don't you go next? What's your sort of response to either the topic this week or whatever else that strikes you? Tour.
Okay.
First of all, where are you from?
I'm from Brazil.
Okay.
Yeah, and my English is a little bit not so good. So
sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, let's see. I guess I'm pretty much with Keith in this. I guess the whole thing about uncertainty to me doesn't seem a big deal. You know, uncertainty is just how things are. Things are uncertain. And I think what rhizomatic learning is about is about doing things in real life. I think the crucial point is real life here. I think we kind of lost this connection to real life somehow, and in trying to like to do things in the real world is. Actually, how we I'm not good at expressing this now, but I think it's about learning how to do things naturally, I guess, as you said about your kids, how you go about learning to solve problems that we find, and how do we deal with things, with real things.
Yeah, it's funny because it seems, I almost wonder if we haven't self-selected too many people who already agree with this, but so many blog posts that I've been reading have been people going, well, yes, of course that's the way that it works. And yet, I spend a lot of time talking to people about state-sponsored curriculum and all this stuff, which just totally spells out every single gram of things that people are supposed to cram into their heads. And at the same meetings where people talk to me about what calculus somebody needs to have in order to get into a science program, you could hand around the calculus assignments from grade 11 and nobody in the room can do them because they don't need to, and that's not what's important about knowing. And yet we have this sort of cultural myth that makes that happen. I don't understand it either. Stella, why don't you go next? I haven't actually heard. I think you're in the conversation, haven't heard from yet. I don't know if you have audio or not, but... maybe while you're figuring that out, we can stare at Sarah's cat for a little longer. Stella? Don't hear. I'll give you another couple seconds, and then we'll we'll go on from there. I will say, if anybody in the chat room has not had an opportunity to come in and you'd like to, there's still, I don't know what, I think we're still maxed out at 10 and these, but we still have some room in here, so by all means, come ahead and join in. And from there, so...
Can I make a quick comment?
Absolutely.
Well, it's really agreeing with a lot of other people. I had a long period out of school doing life stuff and then got back in late, and I realized, comparing back to school with this, this is how I'd been learning things when I was learning on my own, figuring it out for myself. Maybe that has a lot to do with it feeling comfortable. Life, like we've already agreed. It feels, if it doesn't bother you, it's more comfortable. I suppose if it really bothers you, then it's not very comfortable, but that's not my problem, since I'm not...
I jump in on that notion of comfort in terms of some people maintain that the true learning happens when one is out of their comfort zone. Thoughts on that notion and how that impacts in uncertainty and open environments?
I certainly believe that. I believe that because in order to actually learn, we actually have to change in some way. And I think that change for a lot of people involves being a little uncomfortable. And it's one of those words, it depends on we define it, how we feel it. But I think that if learning doesn't involve change, I don't know what it is. I guess it's the way that I look at it. I totally agree with Vanessa in terms of that it's the way that we do everything else. And I think that the anomaly that Keith's talking about of paper and of access, you know, so if I want to learn how to roast coffee in my house, an example I use all the time, 25 years ago, it would have taken me 3 or 4 years to figure it out. Now it took me about 2 hours because mm-hmm. I was able to go to all the places where I get the information and put it together. The learning process may have been exactly as long, but just the access and the abundance makes it so that whereas 5,000 years ago, or let's go further back, 20,000 years ago, I would have wanted to have known how to attack an antelope or sew something so I could be warm. And there's a small sub-selection of the things I could possibly want to know. Now there's a kajillion things I want to know about, so we now have an abundant manner. So we've essentially caught up with the Industrial Revolution in our ability to, there are all these new things that developed, and now we have an ability, like we would have had, to question our community about things 20,000 years ago that we wanted to know. Now we can do the same thing just like we used to. And I've probably totally taken Keith's analogy too far, but I do that
right.
stuff. So, too bad.
Sure. And there's also a knowledge base in terms of how do I fix my phone, or how do I fix my... Well, I do. I search it on YouTube, and there's invariably a number of videos step-by-step on how to accomplish a particular task, be it
right.
roasting coffee, fixing my BlackBerry, or whatever it might be.
So I'm going to go ahead, and as Sarah seems to be the only person drinking beer, she's probably the most lucid.
you think?
Well, it seems most likely. I'm going to ask the question to you, Sarah. If we all agree that uncertainty at some level makes sense in that sense, how do we convince other people of it? And let's make those other people really simple. Let's say learners in a classroom. How do we go about convincing them that things are actually uncertain?
I teach philosophy, Dave.
Ta-da! I didn't know that.
No. I teach level 1 philosophy. So at the moment we're doing Plato and moral problems. And last semester we did Descartes. And my students get that everything's uncertain. My students sort of get that everything's up for grabs. There are some wrong
answers. How do you get them there? They can't be like that when they come in the door.
No, I suppose they're not. I don't know. One of my best friends always says to anybody, I've got the questions for all of your answers. And that's what he does. Yeah, and I love that. I don't know how you do it. I do it through lots and lots and lots of group work. Every time they think they have an answer, throwing it open to a different point of view, bringing in new things. I think you can only do it by example. But I think there's probably going to be a lot of people who just, you can't do it to.
and can you explain to somebody else how to do it? So, no. I mean, I know what I do in the classroom. And one of the biggest problems with, like, somebody asked me the other day, why don't you just tell people what rhizomatic learning is? And I went, next question. Because to me, to talk about how I teach in a classroom in a way that can be replicated, it's totally a question of my personality. What I would do, what I would get away with, the things that that are going to work for me aren't necessarily going to work for the next person. The things that I see other people doing, I go, wow, I'd love to be able to do that. But nobody would ever buy it if I said it.
But that's the problem, isn't it? Well, you've got to do it by showing them. I'm out evaluating a fantastic course at the moment, just somebody who's just so charismatic, and his students love him. Can't work out what he does, so I'm spending time watching him. He doesn't know what he does. His students don't know what he does.
Uncertain, is it?
Very uncertain. He doesn't know what he's going to say before he says it.
Yeah. Well, and where does that leave you, right? So I totally agree with you because I feel exactly the same way. And one of the reasons why I can get away with trying to run a MOOC in my spare time is that I can stand in front of a video camera, I can turn the video on, I can start talking, and I can stop the video 4 minutes later and I can post it. And when I start, I haven't the foggiest idea what I'm going to say.
Yep.
So, and that's actually not something that I had when I started. Doug will be able to tell you that after 300 live broadcasts, I eventually got to the point where you could turn the switch and I would start talking about whatever topic, to the point where people would call me and say, look, we're missing a speaker for this session that's going on in 15 minutes. We're talking about this. Why don't you go ahead? And I'd go, oh, okay, and then the thing would go up and I'd start to do this. But it's a muscle, right? Like that, like everything else, right? You've got to get there.
Yep.
But I can't explain how I do it. I'm not saying it's particularly fantastic either, but the thing that I'm able to do is not something I can explain.
No, and that's the problem with educational research. You don't really know what you're doing, how you're doing it. All you can do is write up your nice little experiment, case study.
So what we're talking about isn't replicable. That's good. Nope. It's not replicable, we can't explain it to anybody, and we can't define it. That's good.
Yep.
Anybody have a solution for that?
I think two. I've got be open to the dialogue and present yourself as a learner as opposed to an expert. And I think you do that every time you engage in any group. Is you may have some notion go through it, but you're certainly open to the discussion and the give and take. And are happy not presenting yourself as the expert, but willing to let the conversation take you and everyone else where it may go. Those are two things that anybody can do, I think. And as you say, the more you practice it, the more you might see that that works.
Interesting comment in the chat room. Mark is saying that students already know that there's no guarantee. It's parents and educators who are still propping up the notion that college is a ticket to happy life. And I think that parents piece, the guaranteed negotiation piece, is a big part of it. We were looking through, long story short, looking through a database of old newspapers here on the island, on Prince Edward Island, and found a newspaper from 1928 where Bonnie's grandfather won first prize in grade 4 for his ability to do a recitation. We had no idea he'd ever won any of those things. It turns out he won them almost every year. The only thing he really tells us about is how much he hated school and how much he got beat with a dictionary in order to get his recitations right. And that is the education system that many of the people that we're talking to are founded in, where the reward, the goal was being able to show off what little monkey could do when I asked them to recite their timetables, because that's the outcome. And, you know, that's true of anything. We're looking at revamping the way we do our orientation and transition here at the university. And, you know, we have these really great fundraising events. And they do really, really, really well because the students can tell year to year whether or not they're succeeding based on how much money they're raising. And the more we look at it, the more we realize that the events that students are gravitating towards are all the ones in which success can be measured. So whether it's fundraising or sports events or whatever else, the common denominator between all the ones that are easy to do is the fact that they're quantifiably observable for success. Right, so this, to me, in my mind, this education system that we built this way totally infects all the way that we look at all the rest of these things, right? And that's a challenge, is that we have these people coming to our classroom programmed to not look at it this way. Unfortunately, Sarah won't tell us how to deprogram them, even though she seems to know. So I wonder, does somebody else want to take a run at it? Somebody else want to, actually, just before I say that, does anybody else want to drop their email in the chat room? Go ahead, and I'll pull you in, and you can join the discussion and explain to us what we're missing. So does anybody else want to jump in? We've got about, oh, wow, look at the time fly. 10 minutes before 5:30.
Can I say something?
By all means.
I was thinking, well, you were saying about learning by doing. And yes. One thing that was on my mind is that all this is very much about abstract concepts, theory. And something that I started to figure is that it's also possible to go doing this in relation to theory, you know? The way we relate to, because actually theory, that is, we are talking about a concept, we are talking about a metaphor, and the metaphor itself, the way we deal with the metaphor, the way we deal with the theory itself, is doing. It is doing. Theory is also doing. It's also part of life, and the two things are not separate. And I guess it's also to me it's seeming important also to realize that there is. There are different ways to relate to concepts and to theory and how these connect to life itself, which is the important thing, actually. Not taking back what I said before, because theory is also part of life, but I think you get what I mean.
I totally get what you mean, and actually, you've exposed the secret curriculum. For me, my entire project for this course was to approach rhizomatic learning from the position of doing, so that every time I get asked to describe anything, I won't say anything, because to me, the only way to come to know in this way is to do. And the great thing is that by the end of this course, when I ask the question, what is rhizomatic learning, I hope everybody ignores me. But for those of you who do not and take a run at it anyway, I expect that we'll get entirely different ideas of what that might be for those people, for their context. I'm totally fine with that. Because to me, what we're doing is taking that theory and approaching it from the position of doing, from the position of the sharing and the sort of wandering that we're doing and the focusing and the stuff that Keith is talking about earlier, where he, you know, finds one, I forget the term he used, but one place to hook yourself, where you can attach yourself to a part of what's going on. And those choices are inevitably going to lead to the paths that we end up going down. It's funny that somebody mentioned Khalil Gibran. The weird thing about this is that all the way through this course, people keep coming up with what is known in the West as Eastern mysticism. So we're coming up with Hindu texts. I've heard Zen koans mentioned. We've got all kinds of stuff coming up, and there's a lot of sort of that end of the philosophical spectrum that keeps coming up over and over again. I think there's something revealing about that, which I'll not expound on in proper Zen Koan way. But I'll tell you what, folks, we've been here for almost an hour already. I really can't believe that. But so does anybody have any final thoughts that they'd like to add into this? Because I'm going to have to shut this down.
Yeah, I have just one final thought about theory, but this thing that I said before, because where does this leave us? What do we do with this, actually? I think, what's the use of this, actually? The use for me, from what I got so far, is that at some point you're going to be facing, for example, a classroom of people, and this can help you face this situation. That's it. I guess for me, this sums up.
I couldn't say it. I couldn't say it any better. Anybody else? Oh, Keith's going for his mute button, I think. Is that what he's going for? He's wandering around like he wants one last thought, but his mute button's still on. I'll unmute him from here. Oh, there he goes.
Yeah, I would like to add, I think we make a mistake if we assume that the rhizome excludes or is somehow other than structure.
Oh, I see what you mean.
It includes structure, and it's part of what we have to do is to build structure within within the rhizome, the real insight that I get from Deleuze and Guattari is that, yeah, you have to do that, but don't be surprised when something deterritorializes and reterritorializes someplace else as something that you didn't expect, because that happens in reality all the time. And as soon as we get all our little ducks in a row, one of them runs away and becomes something else. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's just a very accurate view, image of what happens in life. We build up our little structures, and they work for a while, then they cease to work. And rather than let that destroy us, we move on and we form more structures. And there's the uncertainty. We don't know how long they're going to last. We don't know how long this answer is going to be the right answer. But by golly, it seems to be working pretty well now, so run with it. Keep your one eye out for the new answer, because it's just around the corner.
Sounds like the history of economics.
Seems so.
Anybody else? Last words? I'm eventually going to have to go. I think I've left some little children hanging out on the side of the road somewhere in the freezing cold. Not quite really. I'm just exaggerating, but I have to go pick them up. Any other last comments? Daddy, please, come help me.
About the structure. At the same time, I know it's visualizing rather than being the close reader of Deleuze or anything like that, but it feels like, and it reminds me of a combination of a maze and a palimpsest.
Okay, give me a little more on that.
Well, part of that is I was doing work on ways that people imagine city space in order to cope with the complexity.
Okay.
And a maze is a very common image. You know, the city is a maze. But it's also a palimpsest because it's layers from the past and going down and like an archaeological site. So you have down and up as well as the maze. Now, by the time I threw in the quincunx, my director said, no, that's enough. Stop. And it was very fortunate that I hadn't come across the rhizome, or I thought, oh, this is even better for visualizing the complexity than the two I worked out by mashing them up together.
That's great. All right. So, folks, we just hit 5:30, and I'm going to have to go. But thanks very much for coming. It's been really, I think, I'm so glad that I ignored my original plan and kept this conversation going, because I think that I always enjoyed an awful lot more to be able to engage with people. And I think that I think as much as I like the idea conceptually of the separate hangouts and stuff, for me at least, this makes way more sense. And especially because I don't need to be here when you guys have other meetings, and I think it's perfectly great, like, by all means. And there have been other groups that have come together and stuff. I don't think I need to organize separate breakout conversations for other people.
We can do it for ourselves.
You can do it for yourselves.
Yeah,
I think
that's
right. Yeah, I think so. So I think that this is a way better approach. I think we'll keep going like this. I think we'll keep using this because it's a perfectly reasonable way of going about doing it. But, yeah. And besides, everybody's already got this link, so sending them somewhere else would be conceptually challenging. But, yeah. So thanks, everybody. Thank you for coming. Thank you for participating and giving your input. I apologize for not referring to the chat room as much as I could have. I did copy and paste the content in there. I will read it at some point. We'll see you out there. I mean, we'll see you in all the different places we are, and we'll keep that conversation going. Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
Fantastic. Thanks, Jay. Bye, all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And remember that sometimes benign neglect is a decent form of parenting. That's what my mother always said. She said she was a firm believer in benign neglect.
Maybe that's my approach to teaching, too.
Although some places you bring it up, it's not always well received.
See you later, guys.